Hello and a very warm welcome to our session from the Bruegel Annual Meeting 2021, our live session, which is also going to be run as a podcast. So it's the Sound of Economics live session. And we are very pleased today to discuss the EU Recovery Fund and the state of play and the outlook. And with us to discuss this very, very important topic is today the first Vice President and Minister of the Economy and Finance, Nadia Calviño from Spain. The minister has been, before joining the Spanish government a few years ago, has been a Director General for the budget of the European Union here in Brussels, and we know each other still from that time. And of course, having been a Director General of the budget, she knows not only the workings of the EU budget very, very well, but now as a finance minister, she's very closely involved and a key person for the Spanish recovery and resilience, the recovery program. And Spain, of course, has been one of the first countries where the EU Recovery Fund has been approved and has requested 70 billion in transfers to support the recovery in Spain to improve the digitalization and environmental goals. And of course, with these requested amounts, there's also the idea to enact certain reforms in the Spanish economy. So we want to hear from the minister first about the state of play, from the first vice president, about the state of play in Spain, but also, of course, on the European level, where she sees the main opportunities and challenges. But then we also want to really engage as interactively as possible in a conversation with our second panelist, Carolina Eckholm. She is a professor of economics at the University of Stockholm, and she has also been a member of the Swedish government before being a state secretary in the Swedish finance ministry. And last but not least, she is a Bruegel board member and is therefore also a longstanding friend of Bruegel. So we want to discuss as interactively as possible the state of play of the recovery fund, and want to really start with you, first vice president, and if I may say so, Nadia, to hear from you, where do we stand on the Spanish recovery program and on the European recovery program?
Well, thank you very much for the invitation, Guntram. Also, thank you very much for your kind words. And obviously, thank you to Carolina for being available so that we can interact, even if it is unfortunately still through a screen. I hope that we can see each other in person soon. And I think it is a very timely discussion because indeed there have been important positive developments throughout the summer. The recovery plans were adopted approved by the Council, by the ECOFIN Council. The first disbursement of funds has already happened. Spain has been indeed one of the countries that has received the first prepayment. 9 billion euros have been transferred to our accounts of the Treasury. And therefore, we are, let's say, you know, up and running in the implementation of the Next Generation EU program. So I think it could be interesting to touch upon three issues, and then I'm more than happy to take questions and to interact. First, a reflection on the recovery. Secondly, a bit on the recovery plan in Spain. And then thirdly, where are we and what's the outlook? First, I would like to not to look back a lot, but to pay tribute to the response we have provided as Europeans to this pandemic without precedents and you know, unprecedented in our lifetimes, but obviously in the last 100 years in terms of the health crisis. No, and The economic outlook for Spain is quite positive. It has been revised upwards, as is the case for the Eurozone and broadly for the EU as a whole. We expect growth to reach 6.5% this year, 7% next year. Growth data from the second quarter with a 2.8% growth quarter on quarter, confirm that there is a very strong recovery, which is already underway. And the numbers we get from the labor market are also very positive. Data from August show that we have recovered the number of people enrolled in the social security. We have already recovered the level before the crisis. The number of workers under short-term work schemes are below 300,000, which is a very low number, you know, incomparable to what anybody would have forecasted last spring. All institutes foresaw a very important increase of unemployment in Spain and a recovery that would take many years to come. Actually, all forecasts institutes foresee that in 2022 we will have recovered the GDP level pre-pandemic GDP level, and in 2023 we will be back on the growth track where we were before March 2020. This means that in 3 years' time, we could be back on track. And this compares to more than 10, even 12 years when we were talking about employment for the previous financial crisis. And I don't think this just happened naturally. You know, this is due to the good response we provided since March last year with very effective measures, providing liquidity, supporting short-term work schemes, and avoiding the structural destruction that would have taken place if we didn't provide a very serious response. This is the short-term analysis, but second point I wanted to make is also, Europe has not only reacted with liquidity short-term measures, which have been instrumental and very important together with ECB, it has also looked a bit beyond the short-term and has established this recovery plan. And the Next Generation EU program, I think, is extremely important because it is not only talking about growth, it is also talking about an inclusive and sustainable recovery. And so it is pushing for structural reforms and investments, which put all countries on the same roadmap, you know, to have a green and digital recovery and a fair recovery. Just came from a presentation by President Sanchez introducing the priorities we have for the new term. Now that we're back, you know, in the political turmoil in Madrid. And he was talking about fairness as one of the core values that we really want to preserve. And this has to do with social fairness between the different parts of society. It is territorial fairness in a country such as Spain, which is so decentralized. This is extremely important, as is the case in many other countries. It also has to do with fairness within Europe, obviously, when we're talking about territorial fairness. Intergenerational fairness, thinking about the youth. And also intergender fairness. You know, gender equality is one of the axes of our recovery plan. So I think the second element, the fact that we're all going to be moving in the same direction, will have very positive spillover effects and impacts, which are going to make our recovery stronger and more sustained in the mid-run. And the Spanish recovery plan is particularly ambitious. From a quantitative point of view, indeed, we have already provided the plan for the 70 billion in transfers. It is ambitious in the qualitative, from a qualitative point of view, because of the ambition of the structural reforms that we're undertaking. And it is very ambitious time-wise, because we want to front-load investments and reforms to 2021 to 2023, so that we avoid the investment gap, which is characteristic of previous crises. And that we are was dragging growth in Spain since 2008. And we really want to sort of have a strong kickstart and a strong transformation of the Spanish economy and society going forward. And the third and my final remark is about where are we? You know, what is the where are we with the implementation of the plan? We didn't start from scratch. Luckily, for the last 3 years, we have followed a roadmap which was based on an economic policy which has been coherent, and we have been putting our money where our mouth is and then doing what we have anticipated and announced, trying to provide as much legal certainty and a climate, a business climate that was favorable, based on three elements: fiscal responsibility, social justice, and structural reforms, future-oriented structural reforms. And these three axes have put us in a very good position, because in many of the reforms, we had already made important progress when the pandemic hit us, and we didn't stop whilst responding to the pandemic. And that has allowed us, for example, in the last 2-3 months, even yesterday, to already make have the first round of the university reform, the law for improving business climate and growth of companies, also startup law, the education law, the vocational training law. So all these reforms are going to be, you know, put on the stream of the legislator, of the Congress. Some of them have already been approved by Congress, and so they will start to be implemented. And that puts us in a good position to, you know, have this structural transformation in the coming 2 years. And likewise for investments, we have adopted legislation to remove investment bottlenecks. We have published calls for interest. We have transferred more than 7 billion euros already to the regions so that they can act within their competences, for example, in building renewal, renovation, ecosystem protection and renovation, social policies, so they can start deploying those investments. They will accelerate as of now in the final part of the year. And we have announced also a number of structural projects, transformational projects, of which the most mature one is the one to make sure that Spain is one of the leading countries in deploying the electric vehicle. Spain is the second car manufacturer and exporter in Europe, and we want to remain so with the new technologies. And so this strategic project is undoubtedly one of the most important ones, but we will be deploying a limited number of these strategic projects so that we can make sure that these investments lead to a structural modernization of the country. So we are absolutely committed to this recovery plan. I see a very good business climate. I was today talking to many of the large Spanish firms and also social partners. They are very engaged to try to undertake together these reforms and investments, because I think we're all aware this is a unique opportunity. We cannot miss it. We have to get it right. So far we have, I think, in the response of the pandemic. So let's keep it that way. That would be my final remark. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Vice President. Thank you so much, Nadia. Carolina, let's move to you. You come, of course, from Sweden. And I think there were more than a few people in Sweden that were quite skeptical about Next Generation EU and about, you know, this whole EU recovery program and what it could achieve. What are your first reactions to what we just heard?
Well, I was going to start by mentioning the fact that I am from one of these member states that wasn't too keen on having this facility in the first place. So I would be, perhaps should be more specific. I think the reluctance was to have the grant-based part of the recovery fund, not really the loan-based one, but certainly Sweden has been part of this so-called frugal group of countries that are dragging their feet when it comes to these kinds of instruments. I have to say that I think even here, there is appreciation regarding the fact that it's an instrument that could encourage structural reform in the member states. I think that's something that is a strong interest of also the frugal countries. And I would probably view this instrument more in the category of facilitating or promoting long-run growth potential rather than being something that boosts aggregate demand and could facilitate a recovery from an economic slump connected to the corona crisis. I think both the partly the way it is shaped and also the timing of when funds are going to be paid out is more conducive to increasing potential growth, let's put it like that. And I think that is viewed as a positive thing for everyone, I would imagine. Of course, then there are concerns regarding how this is going to be implemented and if countries are going to be able to achieve what they have signed up to in their recovery plans. My assessment is that on paper, there seem to be very strong mechanisms to make sure that the member states carry out their agreed recovery plans. But then, of course, it will we will just see how this play out in practice. I think there are some factors also being in favor of success in this regard. I think the Commission has a very strong interest in being able to show success for this program. It is a unique opportunity for the Commission to influence policies in the member states. So I think they have a very strong interest in showing that they can play their part in this. And then, of course, it's going to be very important for them to show that they're also able to withhold funds if countries end up being off track regarding their recovery plans. I think there are some difficulties further down the line. I think that it will be a bit, it's going to be a challenge to assess whether whether plans or the reforms are and investments are on track, because some of the commitments in the recovery plans are a bit vague, as I that's how I interpret it. So that's going to be a challenge. And also, finally, of course, there may be very sensitive political situations when countries seem to be off track and the Commission perhaps would want to withhold funds, and the political circumstances may be such that that would put that would end up risking this member state to be a fully engaged member in the union. So that's the risk and challenges that I see.
So thank you. Thank you, Carolina. Nadia, let's try to perhaps unpack those various points and talk about them one by one. I think one important question that Carolina is raising is about, you know, to what extent this is a support for short-term demand versus really a long-term growth program. And if I can sort of add to that question, I mean, if you look at the Spanish program, and I think you mentioned it yourself, there's this important component of front-loading the investment and having very early on quite a big chunk of the next generation EU funds coming to Spain. Now, I guess the immediate question is, can that be absorbed so quickly? Because absorption rates are often for EU funds not so high, and it takes some time. And what happens when the absorption has succeeded and the funds are actually coming down? Because then you have a double fiscal challenge in a few years down the road. On the one hand, there's less funds coming from Brussels. But on the other hand, you also have the EU fiscal rules kicking in, requiring you to consolidate the deficits. So I'm looking at the time profile. I'm a little bit worried also about sort of the second phase of the of the recovery fund when there's actually going to be less funds coming from Brussels, and on top of it, the EU fiscal rules starting to bite again. So can you just walk us through a little bit the time profile, the front-loading issue, the demand stimulus, and then the extent to which this actually supports medium-term growth?
Yes, thank you for your remarks, Carolina. And you can imagine this is something you're touching upon issues on which I have been reflecting very intensely for the last year in order to try to get it right. And I have to say, I think the grant element of the plan, which is a novelty, we're borrowing together to invest together in our common future, you know, as I would put it. The grant element is absolutely indispensable. There has been a jump in the debt to GDP ratios of all countries. It's the case with Spain. We're very close to 120% of GDP because of the response to the pandemic. We are going to start going down already this year. But nevertheless, all member states have had this jump. If we would not have had the grant element, there would be a very strong disincentive to actually borrow this money. And I think that would have led to a clear market failure of underinvestment. What we see in previous pandemics throughout history is that there is a drop in investment after this kind of crisis. In the case of Spain, we used to have around 4 or 5% of GDP of investment before 2008. This dropped of public investment. This dropped to 2%. And it remained so for a decade. So there was already a very large investment gap in the country, which means we didn't invest enough to renew our roads and our airports, also hospitals and public buildings and all public investments, including social networks. And that means that there was a very strong risk that the country would have been lagging even more behind if we didn't have this recovery plan. So to us, the recovery plan is indispensable and the grant element is absolutely indispensable to avoid that we worsen the debt to GDP situation. I think markets also would have reacted very differently if the European recovery plan would not have had a grant. So I am there, you know, 200% convinced we have done the right thing. And I thought a lot about this front loading or not. You have to realize that Spain also has around 38 billion of structural funds that will come from 2021 to 2027. So that gives us a whole period of 2021 to 2026 or 2027 even, where there will be a strong flow of funds coming from the EU, and we need to make sure that we use them in the most efficient manner possible. And this makes it imperative that we do the structural reforms in the first 2 or 3 years. Also, it is the political legislature in Spain, so that we have committed until the end of the political mandate in the country to undertake all these transformational investments and reforms. The approach is not a short-term one, because I probably would not have been able to say this 6 months ago. Now that we see the numbers, if the recovery continues, if the tourism sector continues, if the vaccination rates continue to progress, I mean, we have reached 70% of the population today. We are national tourism has fully recovered. International tourism is also on the right track. We estimate that there are around 60 billion of retained consumption savings, forced savings in the country, which are going to be transferred into consumption. So I would say we do not need these funds for the short term to kickstart growth in the short term. We need these funds to undertake the necessary investments for the mid to long run. And I think we are absolutely on the same boat. If the economy in Italy, Spain, those countries that have been hit the most by the pandemic and economically, if our economies would have been dragging behind, that would have been a drag for growth and recovery in the whole of Europe. So I think there is a win-win situation in the success in the implementation, not only for the Commission, for all of us.
Of course, I think this this is I mean, I think it's really in the interest of all European countries that this program becomes a big success, because there are these positive spillovers. It's really beneficial if one country grows more, not just for that country, but also for the rest of the EU. And I frankly speaking, I also do think that the grant element was quite important in ensuring that markets reacted positively. I mean, it really helped bring down borrowing costs tremendously across significant parts of the EU. And, you know, in doing so, it helped shape the national response in the immediacy to the crisis, and so made sure that we didn't enter into the double dip recession or a big additional recession as we did in the previous financial crisis. Perhaps one point to add, also very much agree on the importance of investment. When we look at the EU numbers for the last global financial crisis, public investment actually for the EU as a whole dropped by 0.8%, almost 1% of GDP. And that was a very, very big drop, which lasted for some time. So the big question is, can we keep it up this time? And in fact, even increase it, because we will have to invest more in climate issues. That's a paper we are going to present actually in 10 days at the informal ECOFIN in Ljubljana in Slovenia. So the paper will be released then. But now going back to Spain, I would love to hear from you, Nadia, about the reforms, because the Spanish program has a lot of reforms promised, very big reforms. There are issues such as duality of the labor market, pension reform, many, many issues mentioned there. And I guess my question is, how would you evaluate that these reforms have succeeded? I mean, at what stage, and how do you evaluate that they have succeeded?
Yeah, indeed, our reform program, as I said, is very ambitious, because it was not sort of coming, you know, out of an illumination one morning. We have been for 3 years having this reform agenda. We were one of the countries, I think, that had one of the most ambitious green. It's called energy and environment plan. No, I think Sweden is also one of the countries that has a very ambitious green transformation agenda, and we have been pushing this agenda for the last 3 years, increasing the weight of renewables, supporting energy efficiency, and forcing this green transformation. No? And likewise, we were also quite advanced with the education reform. And that allowed us to approve it, to get the Congress to approve it. And now we're moving to the phase of vocational training and university. I am repeating it because I think education is, without any doubt, one of those elements that will make it a success or not, you know, the recovery plan. Then we have also made good progress in the area of facilitating business climate and company growth, and that will be also an important push. Likewise, for digitalization, we start from a very good point in terms of connectivity, broadband, also innovation. And so we are, that is more investment, but there are also some structural reforms that have to do with digitalization. And then we have justice, labor market, pension reform, also insolvency law reform. Okay, insolvency law, we have also made very good progress. And our plan is that by the end of this year, we will have done the core of labor market reform. We have already approved the first phase of pension reform, and there is a second deadline also around the end of the year. And so this front loading is not only, as I was saying, paying lip service. We are accelerating those reforms. Of course, some of them are extremely sensitive from a social point of view, and we want to do them hand by hand with the social partners who have behaved very responsibly since the pandemic broke. And today I was with them this morning with the unions, the most important two unions were there in the meeting, and they both have a very, I think, constructive attitude. They understand this is a great opportunity for the country. Does it mean that it will be easy? No. The positions of business positions and the unions are very different. But, you know, we have to do it. And the sooner the better, so that we can make sure that the recovery is also fair and creates good quality jobs, which I think is the aim throughout Europe.
So Carolina, perhaps a question to you coming into this conversation. You expressed some of the Swedish skepticism. Now, suppose in 2 years down the road, we see that this program really has been a success. It has triggered major reforms. It has triggered investment. It has helped sustain demand, but at the same time increased potential growth in the EU. What would it take, do you think, from a Swedish perspective, to make such a next generation EU program a more permanent feature of the EU fiscal architecture?
I should unmute myself. it's a very good question. I think part of the reason why some countries are so reluctant regarding entering into more of fiscal integration, let's put it like that, is because at this juncture there are such differences between countries. So of course, there are large differences regarding public indebtedness, but there are also large differences regarding the kind of institutions that you have surrounding policy making. And I think, you know, in a future where this sort of facilitates reform throughout the union in a way that makes the member states more on an equal footing at the outset, I don't think that countries such as Sweden would be so hesitant as has been the case in the past. But of course, to enter into more fiscal integration with countries that look very weak from a public finance perspective is not a very appealing proposition, of course. So given the, you know, if that's going to continue, I'm pretty sure that there will be it will be a bit of a struggle to get countries such as Sweden on board.
So, Nadia, before we turn to questions from the audience, and let me remind our audience that you can ask questions through Slido and, you know, type in the code BAM21FUND, and then you can ask your questions and I can read them here on my smartphone. Before we turn to the questions, let me ask you, Nadia, about the repayment of the EU debt. I mean, the European Council had agreed that this EU debt will be repaid. I think the deadline is 2058, if I remember correctly. So it will be repaid over a very long period of time. And there was the hope that it would be repaid out of EU funds, so proper funds, own resources, own taxes, and so on and so forth. Now, we've seen several attempts of the EU to raise some proper funds. But I think whenever a new tax comes up, such as the emission trading system revenues or possibly the carbon border adjustment mechanism, or other mechanisms, these funds disappear more quickly than one can imagine and are immediately spent on many other issues. What would be your strategy in terms of repayment of the EU debt?
Well, I certainly think that we need to have these new own resources. That has been an issue, you know, floating above us for a while. As an ex-director general for the budget, I am even stronger, you know, is very vocal for that. But also in my current position, I mean, Spain strongly supports that we make progress in this direction. I think the European Parliament is also going, you know, not going to forget this issue. And so now we need to make sure that these new own resources do not detract resources that were already flowing to national budgets. And that is a tricky question. I mean, Carolina was talking about different countries having different kind of situations. I would say also in the case of Spain, we already have a digital tax. We already have an FTT, a financial transaction tax. And so it would not make a lot of sense that the resources go from the national budget to the European budget. That would not be new on resources as such. No. So we have to bear this in mind. And we very strongly support all that has to do with, you know, reviewing our tax systems in the area of green incentives, and in particular the carbon border adjustment mechanism. And this is not so much an issue of resources. It is more an issue of fairness and sustainability of our green agenda. I do not think we will be able to continue to push for very strong green standards as we want and many other countries, including Sweden, want, if companies see that this is a competitive disadvantage vis-a-vis the rest of the world. And we have to make sure that European companies are not put at a disadvantage compared to the rest of jurisdictions. I think that the change in the American administration may open opportunities. We discussed this in the last G20 meeting, and I'm sure this is going to be a standing issue, like there has been progress on digital taxation and more generally on avoiding the run to the bottom in terms of corporate taxation throughout the world. So things are also moving in the global arena that may allow us to make progress on this soon. And likewise, let me close with this, which is not linked to own resources, but also other European policies. We have to be very mindful that we do not lose citizens in the green, the new Green Deal. And we need to make sure that the green transition is fair. We have made, for example, a big effort in closing the mines in Spain, and this has been done through negotiations with the unions and partnership, and that has allowed us to have a good transition there so far. But now electricity prices are spiking up, they're very high, and this is occupying the headlines every day. I don't know what the situation is in other European countries. In most of them, wholesale prices are as high as in Spain. And this is a very sensitive issue, which we have to be very mindful of, because we have to make sure that citizens are on board when we are embarking in this very deep structural transformation, which we fully support and we want to be leading.
So on this issue, there is actually a question from the audience. Luca Franza is asking that you spoke about fairness, but some Fit for 55 measures, such as ETS extension, the phase out of oil-based cars by 2035, and others, could hurt vulnerable people. What's your position? I mean, how do we deal with this issue? I mean, we can't hide from the fact that some of these issues will hurt ordinary citizens. So how do we deal with this?
Well, we're currently analyzing the Fit for 55 package, which is extremely relevant and includes many measures which need to be very carefully evaluated and calibrated before we move ahead, frankly, because we need to make sure that we reach those targets whilst, as I was saying, protecting the most vulnerable in our societies and ensuring that the progress and the program is fair throughout Europe also, because these are areas where the starting positions are very different and the abilities of the different countries, but also their exposure to climate change is very different. just to give you an example, we're talking about carbon absorption by the land. Of course, the capacity of a country in the north of Europe is very different to the country, to a country such as Spain, which is exposed to desertification, actually. No, our challenge is very different. So we have to be very careful that the process that we design is one which is also sustainable from the economic and social point of view for all of us. I'm sure we will be having more chances to discuss this in depth. And this has to be a serious debate, I think, because we absolutely have to get this right for the sake of future generations.
So let me turn to some perhaps more technical questions, but still very important question. One question by the most popular question, actually, by my colleague Joel Darvas. He's asking, well, Spain was particularly slow in absorbing standard EU structural funds in the past. How will Spain be able to absorb the heavily front-loaded recovery money? How is that going to happen?
Yes, Spain is, I would describe it as slow but sure. So we, in the last multi-annual financial framework, Spain was slow, but manages always to invest the whole amount. There are many reasons, and we could spend 1 hour to explain why this was the case. But I would say that the main challenge that we would have for these investments to be deployed is administrative capacity. In a country which has been for more than a decade divested, you know, of the public capacity, both at the central level, in the regions, and at local level. You know, for many years, there has been a reduction of the ability of the administration to actually invest and invest together with the private sector. And so now what we are doing is first removing bottlenecks and rules which do not add value to the control of the good use of the funds, which is, of course, absolutely imperative. But there were a lot of bureaucratic hurdles that we are trying to remove and enhance all those elements that have to do with digitalization, modernization of the administration, cooperation between the three levels of administration, digital skills also of the public administration. And this together with the system that the finance ministry is setting up for the financial control and reporting, which is also a novelty in terms of the efficiency. And I hope that will also allow us to move to a larger use of e-procurement, etc. This should allow us to be more efficient. But, you know, I would really like to make it clear that Spain has always committed 100%, even though, you know, it may have been more towards the end of the period.
So now I have a question from Gabriel about the same question that I actually asked to Carolina before about sort of the future architecture and the future mechanisms of the EU, given a successful implementation of the RRF, what would be your vision or your ideas about, you know, how this could play out in the next years and how would you want it to play out?
Well, I mean, Spain is a very pro-European country. All political parties, except for the extreme, are very pro-European and very favorable to deepening our economic, social, and political integration. And so we would be, of course, supportive of reinforcing the economic governance instruments going forward. But I think this is this debate is premature. I get this question three times a week anytime I participate. But I would tell Carolina and everybody, we have to focus now on implementing well this plan and making sure this is a success. This is where we have 100% of our energy, 200% actually. Let's come to that when this is a success and we can make the strong case. I am sure we're going to be able, to make. Different question is about other instruments that have been used as a response to this crisis. For example, SURE, which has provided loans in good financial conditions, but it's not so much the financing. We had good access to the market, but I think it's very important that Europe has provided a backstop for the people that we can explain when we support our short-term work schemes, that we can say this is thanks to European support, you know, because that brings Europe closer to citizens and makes it much more understandable what this union means. And I am very strongly supportive of the idea of having a permanent shore, you know, that would be a counter-cyclical kind of stabilization tool that would allow countries to dampen the economic, the volatility of economic cycles, in particular in the labor market, whereas there are no transfers. These are loans. So this is not an instrument as ambitious structurally as Next Generation. But that, I think, would make eminent sense because we already see it has been a success.
How inflation is coming back, and whether that would actually be a problem and seriously interfere with the recovery, and you know what is the situation in Spain, but perhaps also what are the implications for the European Central Bank and other central banks. And perhaps I start off with Carolina, not on the Spain part, but on sort of how worried are you about global inflation surging and, you know, being a problem for the recovery and perhaps also monetary policy needing to become more hawkish more quickly?
Well, I mean, at a very sort of basic level, inflation is affected by the amount of slack in the economy and by inflation expectations. So inflation is, it seems to be increasing, but I think most central banks, they make the assessment that it's mainly transitory factors because, I mean, there are base effects. Inflation dropped at the outset of the corona crisis and so forth. I mean, there is, of course, potential concern regarding slack. I don't see that as a big concern in most part of Europe. I think it could be a concern in the United States. Most part of Europe, probably there are plenty of available resources still. And then there's inflation expectations. Of course, that's, I think, you know, with what has been happening recently with the ECB scooping up a lot of government debt and other types of financial assets, there's uncertainty regarding what monetary policy is going to look like in the future. Also, because there is a new strategy and the communication is that we are going to be fairly dovish. So I think that creates somewhat of a risk for increasing inflation expectations and potentially de-anchored inflation expectations. And I would see the best way to avoid ending up in such a situation to have much clearer information from the central banks on how they are going to exit the extraordinary measures that they have been taking lately.
Nadia?
Yes. I was thinking that we, unfortunately, reality doesn't let us rest one single day. You know, we've been so worried about growth and recovery, and then the moment we start to see the light and we start to see that the economy is coming up, then the headlines turn immediately to, oh my God, there's inflation, which should not come as a surprise to anybody, because frankly, compared to the price levels in 2020, in the deep drop of 2020, and considering the stimulus that comes from monetary policy, fiscal policies, but also the strong recovery that we are witnessing in many economies in Europe and in other parts of the world, like the US, you know, it shouldn't come as a surprise. Core inflation continues to be quite subdued insofar as Europe is concerned, and it's the same in Spain. there mostly inflation is due to the spike in energy prices. I already referred to that. I think some elements may be transitory, others depend on our policy decisions. CO2 prices depend on our policy decisions, and they are a structural element of energy prices and therefore corporate costs. And this is where I would emphasize once more, yes, but citizens cannot be the ones that are paying, you know, for this transition, and we have to make sure that we craft our policies and our markets in the right manner. And central bankers can still consider that long-term prospects continue to be one of rather stable price levels going forward. So this is not something that would worry me in the short term. But of course, it's something that we need to be watching carefully if it gets to a higher level or it seems to be a more structural or long-lasting concern. But short term, I think we have to continue to make sure that there is a strong recovery that would put us on a safe footing going forward.
So lots of questions coming in, Nadia. Most, I think, directed really at you and you know, at the situation in Spain. And I think here one that struck my eye is about, again, about structural reforms in Spain. And the question is, you know, how can we ensure that those reforms are not rolled back by the next government? And why was your plan not based on broad political agreement in Spain?
Well, on the issue of political agreement, for the last 3 years, we have had this roadmap, this economic policy roadmap. We have brought all proposals and all reforms, obviously, to Congress and to the Senate, so to the Parliament, and all our reforms have been passed in a Parliament that is quite segmented and where agreements have to be cross-cutting. You know, the result of the elections has brought us a multiplicity of political parties that have to be put together to get the agreement on the reforms. And nevertheless, despite these difficulties, we have been able to bring forward very important reforms so far. And I am quite sure that that's also going to be the case. We have done broad presentations of the plan in Parliament, outside Parliament, with the different stakeholders. And the plan reflects, I think, 99% the broad agreements of the Spanish political system and the Spanish population. We will be, of course, putting all reforms through Parliament, and therefore we are having opportunities to discuss this. And I report to Parliament every 3 months in order to see how things are progressing. So I wouldn't see a big risk of the reforms being unpicked in the future, because they will be based on this broad political agreement. And there is a very strong support by social partners, which is also an important element that would deter, I think, future governments from doing so. Nevertheless, I would very much appreciate it if the main political party in the opposition, the Popular Party, would be more supportive and really jumping, you know, on board and being a partner in terms of the deployment of the plan. I don't lose hope, and I will do my utmost, you know, to get to this strong agreement in the coming weeks and months.
So perhaps the last set of questions, because also in view of the time, we are coming to an end of the time. But I do see several questions here again about, you know, evaluation of the projects, evaluation of funds, ensuring that money does not end up in the wrong hands. It's not being used in corruption, which is, of course, a worry in many countries, and there's a very active debate on this, and you know, also issues such as value for money. I mean, how to ensure that, you know, it goes really into the best kind of projects. Apparently, there was even a European Court of Auditors critique that you know, speeding up fund absorptions, might mean that there's little consideration for value for money. So I think this whole issue, how do we make sure that it's in the end it's evaluated and it's properly done? And I think there is, of course, and Nadia, I want to push you on that. There is the element which is a sort of the project-based evaluation. Then there is the country-based, let's say, administrative evaluation. And then there is, of course, also the political evaluation. And last but not least, there's, of course, also the, let's say, Court of Auditors, corruption, Olaf agencies evaluation and all of that. So do you think we have enough mechanisms in place? And I'm not just speaking about Spain. I'm speaking also for in general about the EU to make sure that these kind of evaluations happen. And would you perhaps, and to push you a bit, which is a bit my view on this, my view is that one key element is also the evaluation and the accountability, political accountability at the European level through the European Parliament, where I think the European Parliament Parliament's role is probably too weak in holding the European Commission to account on what they are doing. So can you just walk us through how you see the entire sort of evaluation process from the individual project to the big picture?
First of all, I think that we do have sufficient instruments. Many would say we have too many instruments that sometimes overlap. And it's a matter of using them in a proportionate manner so that we really take a risk-based approach, which is not creating new bureaucratic hurdles. Judging by the negotiation and the discussions we had with the European Commission for the approval of the plan, which encompassed more than, I have my friend here, one of the persons that participated. How many meetings did we have with the Commission? 1,000? No? No. Thousands of meetings, thousands of calls, thousands of exchanges. They have looked up and down every detail. The standard set for the financial analysis and reporting mechanisms is huge. We also have inside the Spanish administration a very strong audit service that is supervising everything and is the one that's, together with the finance ministry, preparing the whole reporting system also for the regions. I do think that we have sufficient instruments, frankly, to if there is a will to use them well and to avoid mistakes. Having said that, you know, at the end of the day, and I am grateful that the final word is actually on this issue, Guntram, because I think at the end of the day, it will all be about political accountability. And I wouldn't like to go now into European political accountability. What I can tell you is at national level, there is very high political accountability. And I'm sure Carolina will be absolutely in agreement. Huh? When you are in a government, you are exposed to control, the mechanisms that have been in place through the economic governance. But more importantly, you're subject to the control of citizens. And they need to see, they will be the ones saying whether or not this recovery plan is a success, whether or not we got it right. I am quite convinced we have a good plan, we have the resources to make it real, and we have the determination to make it a success. So we have everything, you know, the wind is in our sails to make it a success. Time will tell, and citizens will undoubtedly judge.
Carolina, any last word on evaluation from your side?
Well, I mean, just on this particular issue, I mean, I agree with what Nadia has been saying, but of course, I don't think that there's a lot of concern regarding countries such as Spain, but there may be, I mean, for the whole program, it will be important that there is success everywhere that funds are being used, and there may be other parts of the union where these institutions are just weaker. You said that you and me, we know that the national parliaments are they hold governments to account. That's certainly the case, but there are also countries where there are concerns regarding the democratic institutions and where things are going. And of course, we have the whole discussions about the rule of law in countries such as Poland and Hungary. There have been concerns regarding these kind of systems to track money and making audits in Czech Republic, for instance. So I do think that this is an area where there are also challenges and risks going forward.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, first of all, to our audience for engaging so actively with us, so many questions. And thank you so much, of course, First Vice President and Minister of Finance, Nadia Calviño, for joining us today and spending the 1 hour with us and giving us so many frank and important issues about this, answers about this very, very important recovery plan for Spain and for the European Union. We wish you a lot of success in the implementation. It matters for you, it matters for Spain, and it matters for the European Union. And of course, let me also thank Carolina Ekholm from Bruegel's board and a professor of economics in Stockholm for sharing your insights with us today. Thank you and see you next time. Bye-bye.